I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. It's part two of our six-part series of interviews with Democrats vying to win the Pennsylvania primary on May 19th and become the next mayor of Philadelphia. Yesterday, our guest was Lynn Abraham. Today, it's Doug Oliver's turn. He grew up in the Germantown section of the city and attended five schools by the time he reached eighth grade. He then attended the Milton Hershey School near Hershey, Pennsylvania, and that's a boarding school for economically disadvantaged students. After getting his MBA, he worked in advertising, was press secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare, and later press secretary for the current mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter. He left his job as senior vice president for marketing and corporate communication at the Philadelphia Gas Works, PGW, to run for mayor. This is his first run for public office. He joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Doug Oliver, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for allowing me to be here.
Absolutely. So why do you want to be mayor of Philadelphia?
Number one, I love my city. I love my city, born and raised here. I've seen it at its best. I've seen it just now, having come through the worst economic recession that the city or the country's ever seen. But I am frustrated. I'm frustrated because of my sense that that we refuse as a city to address core problems. We spend time instead addressing derivative problems that are more expensive to solve for. I look at the education that I got and what it's meant to me in terms of my life and the choices that I'm able to make, including being able to take a shot at running for mayor. And I don't see that kids in our city have those same choices. And honestly, that is what drives me in this campaign to find a way to solve for our education challenges.
And I do want to get to education and the number of other really big issues facing the city. But I know that you are focusing your campaign on what has been described, or perhaps what you describe, as disenfranchised voters. These are people who don't generally even go to the polls to vote.
Right.
Why this crowd?
Well, when we look at the city of Philadelphia voter registration numbers, we got about 1.1 million registered voters. They've already taken a step to get registered, so they understand the importance of voting. But when we look at the last few elections, look, the last open mayor's race, most similar to this one, Mayor Nutter's, only 297,000 people came out to vote. That's roughly 30%. That's not enough. In 2011, when he was reelected, only 185,000 people came out. When our district attorney was elected, it dropped down to 10.5%. And so ranging between 10 and 30%, that's terrible. And it says something about our city and where we as a city are and how quickly we can progress to what we want to be. But we've got to find a way to engage more people.
So what is your pitch to these people that are disengaged like this?
Well, it starts with the belief. I reject the belief that they are lethargic or lazy. I think that people have voted in the past and not seen any difference in their personal lives. They have become disenfranchised. They've become frustrated with the system. Nobody talks to them. The feedback that I get as I talk to them is, here you come, you elected officials, coming around here every 4 years. And I almost get chastised for the sins of our fathers. And in this case, I let them vent because they don't have an opportunity in many cases to talk. And so I do seek to reengage frustrated voters and new voters who haven't had a chance yet to participate in local elections.
And from your conversations, broadly speaking, I mean, what do they want that they're not getting from this city and from this government and perhaps even the mayor?
Well, most of the things, you know, I ride the subways every single morning and evening. I personally interact with roughly 400 to 500 people personally every day. The number one thing that everyone talks about is education. Interestingly enough, they don't get down into the weeds. They just know something's wrong. We want somebody to fix it. The second thing they talk about is jobs. You got to create more jobs. But of the people who do talk about jobs, the overwhelming number of the people that I talk to are ex-offenders or people who've been in conflict with the penal system here in the city of Philadelphia. And in a sense that it's, they cannot survive. They can't find the job. And even when they do, the money that they make is taken from them before they can survive. So education and jobs are the 1-2 punch that I hear. And the last thing that encourages me is that they say, I never saw a mayoral candidate down here before.
I mean, literally not walking their street or knocking on their door.
Not walking their street. They will acknowledge that representatives have come. Volunteer base is very effective in doing that. But to see the actual candidate himself, and not just today and not again, every single day, Every single day.
Well, let's take schools. And I mean, you have described the fact that you went to five schools by the time you got to eighth grade, and mm-hmm. you were, it sounds like, a bit of a troublemaker. Fair?
Only for about fifth grade.
Okay.
For a very narrow period of time.
But that's a lot of schools for a young child to go to.
Well, the move, and I credit my mom with the ability to navigate the labyrinth that is the school system here in Philadelphia. But there were a number of reasons. So my first school was Greenfield Elementary. But schools went on strike under Connie Clayton. We used to joke that if she could get out of her door, you had to go to school. Oh, how times have changed.
I didn't know people said that.
Well, we did. We were kids. We were like, what? We don't get a snow day?
Yeah.
It's flurries. and so schools went on strike. And so I left Greenfield. But, you know, my mom, being a single mom, had to figure out what her kids are doing during the day. And so we ended up going to High Street Christian Academy. But that school only served a couple of grades. And so when I aged out of that, I went to Cedar Grove Christian Academy. I failed the fifth grade at Cedar Grove Christian Academy. The second time around, behavior started to kick in. And I think that's a key point, because as we think about what kids are dealing with in schools, a lot of it has nothing to do with their ability to learn. But I was embarrassed after failing the fifth grade. And now these little fourth graders are now fifth graders with me, and I have to find some way to make myself superior. The school was not having that, so they kicked me out. And then I ended up at Pickett Middle School. Now there, I went from being the bully to being the bullied. And so I didn't stay there long either. And then I finally found a decent fit at Hill Freeman, where I graduated the eighth grade. But for many different reasons, I was moving from school to school, and my mom was trying, like any parent, to find the right educational fit for her child.
So using your personal story as an example, how then can the schools be improved? Not all children are going to end up at the Milton Hershey School to get the kind of experience that you had. Most kids are going to stay in the city, and their parents are going to try to find the right place for them.
That's right.
So how does this city make that happen?
Right. And it is my personal experience. I think for all of us, our personal experiences form our worldview. And for me, understanding the value, the benefit of what Milton Hershey gave to me forces us to look at education and forces me to look at education in the city of Philadelphia differently. There's no shortage of conversation about governance of our school district, and we can talk about that. There's no shortage of conversation about the funding. My question is, what are we funding and do we think it'll work? I don't think we spend nearly enough time talking about the curriculum at our school. And also the home life. Last week, my campaign introduced a platform, an addendum to our education platform, and it was called Homework, Schools Homework. Seemed like it made sense. But what it seeks to do is look at what's going on in the homes of our school children as a first step to talking about education. Because if you look at those homes and you see what those adverse childhood experiences are, that's what the social service community calls them. We just called it growing up in Philly. But if you look at the absence of fathers, the absence of supermarkets in neighborhoods, healthy food, illiteracy, violence, so many different things that kids have to navigate even before they get to the classroom. If we don't start there, then we're always going to find reason to blame teachers, and that's a problem.
Well, how do you start there? I mean, taking that as an example, and I don't think anyone would argue with you. I think most people looking at education say that the family plays such a key role, and obviously those first 4 to 5 years of life are so important. How do you intervene? How do you make it a better experience for young children?
I agree with you. It's not a new discussion. Everybody's talked about it, which baffles me that nobody seeks to solve for it.
Okay.
And so that's what I think is unique about what I'm trying to do with my campaign, different from other candidates. And so what I do is, instead of, we've always looked at the school district as being that situation over there that we hope solves itself. That's the school district. Those are the teachers. Those are the buildings. And that's the budget, 2.5. When they run out, man, what a mess, are we raising taxes? That's kind of what it sounds like in layman's terms. What I suggest is that we not just look at the $2.5 billion school district budget, but look at the city's almost $4 billion budget and say, every city agency, why don't you look at your budget through the lens of how we educate kids? Because if we don't have nurses in schools, but we have a health department, there's obviously some things that we can work on. If we don't have counselors, but we've got DHS in homes, if we've got a water department, then why don't we have fresh water in schools? Those are just but three examples of ways that different city agencies can start to think about how we educate kids. And it's not limited to just city agencies, but doing the same thing with city agencies, with social service agencies, with nonprofit community, oftentimes funded by city dollars, and with Eds and Meds, who I think can play a bigger role in making sure that our kids are prepared to learn.
Now, Superintendent Hite has said he needs an additional $103 million. And mm-hmm. we all know what the school district has gone through over the last couple of years. When you look at your plan, or you talk about your plan, is there an additional $103 million in there? Or are you saying we can redistribute what we have?
I think it's a combination of the two. I do not believe, and I don't think most people believe, that every single dollar that comes into the school district is being spent efficiently. I think there's political campaign contributions tied up in the school district's budget somewhere. I can't point to them specifically, but I am a proponent of a forensic style audit of the school district's budget. One of the first things that you do when you get in, not just this is a program, here's how much it costs, but who's operating the program and what are the results of that program? Who's cashing the checks? That's one thing. But if there are new resources that are needed, I think payments in lieu of taxes from nonprofits can generate that money.
Pilots, as they're
pilots,
called.
Or silots, as my pastor always says, you can pay with your time, your talent, or your treasure. Treasure is the money, but time and talent count. And so services in lieu of taxes are something that I'd be happy to discuss with our post-secondary education institutions and medical institutions. Additional, you know, keeping the city open later is one of the things I proposed, to use the liquor by the drink tax to fund schools. And so I think the combination is in there. But let's all talk together about what we're doing. And maybe we can, instead of I spend a dollar, you spend a dollar, we get $2. How about I spend a dollar, you spend a dollar, and we leverage it and we get three? How about we become more efficient and not need to spend as much money?
I know you're one of the people that has thought it would be a good idea for, I guess, bars or maybe even restaurants to stay open until 4 a.m. There's one of the objections to that is it leads to more drinking. But that is one of the ways that there is money raised in Philadelphia to pay for schools. And also it would be a minuscule amount of money.
It would be a part. And one of the things I think we often suffer from here in the city government is letting perfect get in the way of the good. It is a small bite. I mean, the whole discussion about the sale of PGW, we were looking at a $5 billion underfunded pension. They said, well, that's only $500 million. Then what? Well, I don't know. But where's the alternative $500 million? The way you eat an elephant is one bite at a time. And so I don't think that any of the ideas that I'm proposing by themselves get it done. I think it's the collective power of all of them, including investments on the front end that make spending less expensive. My fear is that even if we had all of the money that we wanted, we still would not be educating our kids and preparing them for lives of self-sufficiency. My fear is that even if we solve for the problem this year, we're going to have this same exact conversation next year. So at some point, you have to solve for the bigger issue. Stop solving for the cough and start solving for the pneumonia.
And that's Doug Oliver. He is running for mayor of Philadelphia, one of the six Democrats running for mayor in the city. The primary is May 19th, and we have invited all of the candidates to join us on Radio Times to talk about what they would do if they were mayor. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want from your mayor or the next mayor of Philadelphia? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and also put a comment on our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with Doug Oliver. He wants to be the mayor of Philadelphia, part of a series of interviews that we are doing with mayoral candidates this spring. Also, you can check out WHYY's extensive coverage of the mayor's race, of city council races, election politics, if you go to the Newsworks website. You can also join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about some other things, but education, as you say, is so important. One of the things that you say on your perspective page is parents have choice related to their child's education, but other children don't get left behind. When you say parents should have choice related to their child's education, there is a thing called parental choice, which means they sort of get the money and then they can pick and choose where their child goes to college, goes to school. When you mean choice, what do you mean?
I'm talking about really the concept of fairness. Right now, we get caught up in the conversation in Philadelphia of district schools versus charter schools. And while I understand the concern around both, I think it's a red herring. I think it distracts us from the more important question of whether a school is high performing or not. The most expensive school, the biggest detriment to the city's funding formula is a school that takes even a dime, charter or district, and then doesn't educate a child. Mm. The example I always use is I may buy a necktie for $5. I may buy a necktie for $10. At least I have a necktie that I'm wearing. It's the necktie I spend $1 on that I never wear, that falls apart on day one, that is the most expensive because it gives no value. And so when I think about education, I think about fairness. I think about people who don't have necessarily a mom like I had who can navigate the system. They don't understand the rules, or they don't have the time or resources to move a kid around or to research the way that they otherwise would. And the school system has to work for them as well. So really, choice was less about the charter school, district school mm-hmm. model. It was about the fact that there has to be a high-performing school in everybody's neighborhood. And I'm agnostic as to whether that's a charter school expanding or a district school expanding. But you have to expand into a neighborhood where there's no quality educational choice for a parent.
There's a legislator in Harrisburg that is saying, you know, let's take a look at these underperforming schools and give them a chance to get their acts together. And if they can't do that, then the state's going to take over the running of that. Is that something that you would favor?
I was there for like 75% of what you were saying. And then the end game, I'm not sure that I co-sign on that. What we know is that there are high-performing schools in Philadelphia. We have a few. We could probably name them.
Sure.
District and charter schools.
Sure.
Both of them have enormous waiting lists because every parent wants a good school for their kids. What I would seek to do is consistent with what the legislator is suggesting is give performance improvement plans the way we would in almost any other environment. Resource the school so that they have an opportunity to achieve that improvement. But if they don't, and I'm not talking if over 5 years after now having sent a first grader to the sixth grader reading like a first grader, I mean, if you do not get there quickly, then we change the management of that school. Now, he's suggesting, he or she is suggesting mm-hmm. state takeover. I'm suggesting looking at one of our high performing schools and allowing them to expand into that school so that there's still that resource in that neighborhood. And when you do it that way, you now have an open dialogue with parents. You're not abruptly closing schools, leaving parents in a rut.
Let me read some comments here. We have a Facebook question from Derek, and he wants to know, do you support our municipal unions?
That's a very general question,
it
Derek.
It is a general question.
But I will say, yes, I do. When I think of our municipal unions, and perhaps this is from my time working in city government or just my time as a Philadelphian, the city runs, the lifeblood of the city is the operation, the basic operation of the city comes through our unions. I appreciate the work that they do. They are often overworked, underpaid. They are public servants. All of their lives are as public as mine is. And so, yes, I absolutely do support the unions. I understand the frustration that they've had over the last several years without having had a contract. There is a contract in place now. You have no enemy in me. I think at the end of the day, the things that concern me most as a mayor aren't the upfront economic issues. It's the long-term challenges that face us. But we start with a mutual respect for the work that our unions do and my worldview of that.
You wish you'd gotten some more endorsements from unions?
Yeah, but you know what? I wrote an article. I mean, man, this is going back 3 or 4 years. It was called Indictment of Endorsements. If you look at what unions typically – and I draw a distinction between union leadership and union membership. I don't think that their interests are always aligned, because if their interests were always aligned, there's just too many people affiliated with unions for them to ever lose. If membership and leadership were on the same page, then whoever the union leadership picked would win the mayor's office. And we know – or any office. Mm. And what we see is that typically doesn't happen. And so I think there's a disconnect there. So when I don't get the endorsement, I don't stop pursuing the memberships. If FOP doesn't vote for me, I still talk to police officers. If 33 doesn't pick me, I'm still talking to streets and, you know, local sanitation and others. So because there is a disconnect there.
Speaking of police officers, you were at a forum, and there have been many of them. This, I think, was at Aldea. And the quote was, and this was part of a larger quote, but that mm-hmm. one, the sort of takeaway quote that people really reacted to was that something you said, that police have reason to fear black men.
Mm-hmm.
Can you put that into context for us?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate the opportunity to clarify it, because it was frustrating to me that my word choice got more of the attention than what my position on it is. I was simply trying to acknowledge that we do have some serious tension, particularly in our neighborhoods, between police and African-American men and Latino men. When we look at the behavior of very few police officers who come into the communities and treat those communities with disrespect, it doesn't represent the whole police department, but it does, in fact, reflect on the whole police department, because I don't know which police officer is going to pull me over. Mm-hmm. I'm therefore fearful of police officers generally until I figure it out. I think that sword cuts both ways. There's a very narrow segment of African-American men and Latino men in our city who are very violent, and they terrorize our neighborhood. They do not represent all African-American and Latino men, but their behavior does reflect negatively on all. For the same reason I'm proud when President Barack Obama is elected, because I think it causes people to look at me differently, I too must accept that it causes other people to look at me. And that, if fear wasn't the word, then so be it. Pick the one that you want. But if we're going to fix the relationship, we have to first acknowledge that our behavior as African-American men in our community needs to be addressed, and that police officers have to address the wayward police officers who cause them all the bad press as well.
And I think that the word fear, especially in light of today's, you know, shooting incidents involving police officers, often African-American men, was that fear can be the reason to use deadly force. If you're afraid, then you're allowed to defend yourself against someone. And I think that's why that word.
I totally get that. And I think it was an extrapolation of my point. I certainly didn't intend to, and don't believe that fear is a reason to use deadly force, particularly for a police officer who's empowered with that ability.
That's right.
And so if that was the confusion, then let me state for the record clearly and unequivocally that I expect the police department to treat all communities, and particularly African-American Latino communities, with dignity and respect. But again, you know, being inartful with my words kind of got me tripped up, and that's how I feel.
But I think in certain ways you have identified a problem. I mean, this is a problem between police officers and some of the community in Philadelphia, maybe certain neighborhoods in the city where there is, if not fear, perhaps suspicion, certainly not a good and healthy and cooperative, workable relationship. How do you address that? How do you fix that problem?
Well, again, my point with the comment was that I think it's a bit of a push and a pull. I think one of the reasons why I can say that I would, and I am in favor of ending stop and frisk, is because the statistics don't support it. For all of the people who are stopped and frisked, what we get for what we do to the feeling in the relationships is negligible. It's not enough to warrant the continue. So I actually have ground to stand on as a mayoral candidate, or as a mayor, or as a police commissioner. There's room to stand on and say, here's why we're doing away with it. As long as African-American men are shooting African-American men, the ground you have to stand on to change that becomes a lot more difficult. And so what I think we can do to solve the relationship on the police side is additional training, community policing, police officers walking their beats, not just sensitivity training, but cultural training and understanding why these communities are the way they are. It's because we've disinvested in schools, disinvested in business. That's why they're unsafe, not because the people in them are inherently unsafe. It's less what's wrong with you and more what's happened to you. We as government have a responsibility for keeping those neighborhoods safe. And if you take all the resources out, it is the consequence.
Well, what I also hear you saying, one of the problems here in Philadelphia is black-on-black crime.
That is a challenge. And so if we're going to work on the police officer side to get them in a mindset that they understand that they are there to protect those communities and not to enforce in those communities, we on the African, and I feel perfectly comfortable as an African-American male saying, let's clean up our own yard. Let's give them no reason to come in here. Let's make it plain and simple. One of the things that impressed me, just to zoom out for a second, about Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X. To me, I used to always say I'm more like a Malcolm X guy. You know, if you don't respect me, I'm gonna make you respect me. It was kind of a thing. And I always thought, that Martin Luther King was a little soft around the edges. This was me growing up, and it was like, man, this peace stuff, you got to get angry. But as an adult, and I look at what Martin Luther King did, particularly Selma, the march from Selma to Montgomery, was that he forced, in plain view of everyone, he forced everyone to look at how barbaric African-Americans were being treated. And only at the point when people could see it for exactly what he took away all excuse. And at that moment, he was able to advance real change that's sustainable change and change that is now, you know, it's a foregone conclusion that African Americans are going to vote. That's what it is. That's how we talk about Philadelphia elections and all of those other things. But it first started by making very, very plain what the challenges are. As an African American community, I would love for us to not be the reason that anybody even had the excuse to say they were afraid, because someone with hate in their heart is still going to come in and be disrespectful in those communities, but it would be so plainly evident to everyone else that it was wrong that we would then start to see some of the change we want. That's why I think responsibility is on both sides. If it was white on white crime and they were still coming into black communities, you'd have a real problem. Everyone would. That's why every single mayoral candidate is saying we'd do away with stop and frisk, because if you stopped and frisked in other communities, you'd find the same amount, if not more, paraphernalia and other things on those folks. So there's a give and take there. It requires an honest conversation. Perhaps it should be a private conversation so that it doesn't, you know, lead to, you know, race baiting and pandering and all of those other conversations and criticisms that come from speaking the truth. But we've got to be realistic about what's going on here on both sides.
And that's Doug Oliver, one of the Democrats running for mayor here in the city of Philadelphia. And to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. And we are interviewing all the Democratic candidates. There are six of them. You'll be hearing a lot of them over the next week. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, we have a tweet from Matthew. He says, if elected, would he take on the FOP and make it harder for abusive, corrupt cops to be reinstated through arbitration?
I think, Matt, good question. And yes, one of the biggest challenges that I've witnessed, I think we've all witnessed, is we see police officers going bad. We see the police commissioner do the right thing. Suspend with the intent to terminate or just terminate or however it works. But then we see through an arbitration process that they are reinstated. It's a structural challenge that needs to be addressed. And the time you do it is during contract negotiations. And so as a mayor, not just with FOP, but with all unions, it's not what you want. It's what you can negotiate. Mm. There has to be lots of voices at the table. And I put more I think work rules have far more impact in terms of leadership and the mayor's ability to lead than do the economic issues, which often overshadow those same negotiations. So while police are fighting for additional cash in their checks and overtime and pensions and health care and all of those legitimate conversations, I'd be focused as much, if not more, on getting concessions on work rules to make sure that when there is disrespect in the communities that we can deal with it appropriately and we don't have that officer back on the force wreaking terror, raining terror in neighborhoods. So, yes, I would absolutely take that on as a challenge.
You mentioned jobs. Jobs is another important issue from the people that you talk to. And obviously all the candidates here are looking to energize the environment here in Philadelphia. How do you suggest getting more jobs, and especially jobs that pay a good wage?
Right.
How do you connect the people with the jobs?
Living wage. That's
living
that,
wage.
You know, life sustaining, family raising wages. I am a proponent of increasing minimum wage. I'll start there. Right now, there's a big push to get to $15 an hour.
You would support that?
I can't say whether $15 is the right number. I can tell you that $7 and some change is certainly not. The governor is pushing for $10, but I'm going to be leaning on the governor quite a bit, particularly with full and fair funding formula for our school system. I don't want to complicate that for him by saying, and also deliver me $15 an hour. I'd propose to at least get to where the governor is. If I could make it $25 an hour, I'd be a proponent of it. What I'd want to make sure, though, is that you don't harm business and stop hiring by moving too quickly in one direction or another. So minimum wage is one. But attracting jobs to the city, I think, in two broad areas. One is attracting big business. And I think the biggest indicator of whether a business wants to come to your city or not is whether your school system's working. Can they keep their employees? Will their employees want to stay and raise their families? They have the same problems that we do, and they make the same decisions whether they come or go. That's one. But also our tax structure, I think, is uncompetitive. And I think there's some steps that we can take to make us more competitive by reducing business and wage increasing property to make sure that we're more competitive and can attract those jobs. And then small business, that's really where the nuts and bolts are. 93,000 small businesses employ more than 50% of people in the city of Philadelphia with a job. Mm-hmm. Investing in those neighborhoods and allowing people to create their own way is something that I think the city can do to create jobs.
I'm looking at a Pew report that had looked at job creation here in the city, finding that the percent of the population aged 16 to 64 that is not working or looking for work is 31.9%. I mean, that there are people in the city who are just not in the job market whatsoever.
Right. These are disconnected citizens. So, and a lot of them have been let down by our educational system already. These we're living the results of failed leadership for many, many years. And it's part of the reason why people aren't voting. I'm positive of it. And so finding jobs and training folks for the jobs that are here is another area where I think the city can do a good job. We talked about the PGW sale. One of the critical parts of that conversation was replacing infrastructure underground, pressure on the gas company and gas companies across the state to replace that infrastructure. We don't have enough welders right now to double the amount cut in half the amount of time to replace. Those are jobs we could prepare people for. We have a vibrant tech community who says, hey, Doug, 16-week training program, we can teach you to code. Those are $30, $40 an hour jobs. We can get this done. There's energy efficiency and dilapidated housing we can train for, put people to work. We can use energy to attract manufacturing sector back to Philadelphia. And these are all things that I think a smart mayor is thinking about.
Let's take another short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. We got many, many comments here. Doug Oliver is running for mayor of Philadelphia. And again, the primary, it's a Pennsylvania primary, not just a city primary. Pennsylvania primary is on May 19th. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We got some more comments to join us as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you're just joining us, Doug Oliver is our guest. He worked for a number of years as Senior Vice President for Marketing and Corporate Communication at PGW, the Philadelphia Gas Works. He quit that job to run for mayor. He served before that as Press Secretary for the current mayor of Philadelphia, Michael Nutter. He was born and raised in this city. He actually attended the Milton Hershey School. That's a boarding school outside of Hershey, Pennsylvania, for low-income students, and we are talking about what he wants to do if he becomes the mayor of Philadelphia. You can join our conversation. Call us, actually, 1-888-477-9499, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You were at PGW. My understanding is that you were in favor of the sale of PGW. That was something that did not happen last year. In fact, there was really no vote on it whatsoever in city council. If you had been mayor, how would you have gotten Council President Clark to get this discussion started?
Well, first, I think it's important to I want to make clear that the sale of PGW discussion was never about, from my perspective, never about privatizing or selling PGW. The purpose of selling PGW was to solve for our pension challenge. And so what's non-negotiable is that we address the pension challenge. How we get there is up for negotiation. So for one, I would probably start with a conversation with the council president and other opinion leaders around the city to talk about solving for the pension challenge.
Do you think there wasn't enough of that?
I don't think there
coming
was.
Coming from the Nutter administration?
Well, I don't know I don't know what they did or didn't do in the days leading up to that conversation. I know that there was always a sense that they wanted to study it and see if it was even an idea that they wanted to pitch. I was aware of that. But some of the criticism that you hear coming from the council side is he didn't explore any other options. Now, he very well may have explored other options, but what I think would have been useful is if everybody explored every option together with the idea that our end game is to solve for the pension problem, because that means maybe PGW never comes up for sale. But it was offered. I'm not in favor of privatizing municipal assets, but I'm also not in favor of ignoring the cliff that's sitting in front of us. And so what I liked about the sale was the fact that it generated $500 million to kind of stave off some of the challenges that were coming.
This is the pension crisis.
Correct. I also liked the fact of who. It wasn't just sale to anybody. It was sale to this particular company. It was a small fish eating a big fish. That typically means they'll be worried about indigestion. They're not going to move fast. They have to replace pipeline fast, and they don't have enough people either. They're not going to come in here and fire people. The PUC that provides protections for low-income customers, all of those things gave me a certain comfort level. And I saw that pension cliff, and I thought, if not this, and in the absence of an alternative, let's go with the one that's on the mm-hmm. table. And so I think starting with council and as understanding what the end game was, we don't get caught up in some of the challenges that I think we
got
caught in.
Do you think it's a dead deal at this point, or can it be revived? Or
I think it's a dead deal at this point. And I wouldn't go into office trying to kickstart that. But I would go into office talking about that $2 out of $5 that are going to pensions and health care, expected to grow to $3 out of $5 in the next 10 years. That is the conversation. And so if it's not about how, it's about what.
Let me get Tina from actually Bucks County to join our conversation. Hi, Tina. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I was wondering where you stand with your research in the growing opportunity for renewables. We have the opportunity now to resurrect Philadelphia to be the leading edge of solar infrastructure. Where do we stand with that? And so far as Elon Musk, he's ready to go to resurrect cities.
This is Elon Musk. Yes, the
owner of Tesla and Solar City. He wants to come in and help us, you know, to be able to rejuvenate. I mean, it would be unbelievable potential for Philadelphia to become a beautiful, sustainable, abundant city with all that energy and being able to regrow in that way. Where do you stand with looking into any of that?
Sure, Tina. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Tina. I do think that we should be I'm a fan of Mayor Nutter's sustainability plan. I think we have an obligation to continue that work. I think part of the reason we have so many young people coming to the city in droves and we're winning that war for the future is because we've made a commitment to be green and to think about some of these things. Specifically, when we're talking about wind and solar, one of the biggest challenges with those things is that there hasn't been enough investment in them. And for that reason, I definitely see them as the future of any progressive city. But as of right now, could we provide all of the heat and electricity that this city needs just on solar and wind? The answer is probably no for now. I think we have an obligation to try and figure out how to make that happen. In the meantime, when I think environment, I think sustainability, I can't help but think from my perspective at natural gas, using combined heat and power, which is one of the ways I was able to double the amount of natural gas coming through our pipelines, was by distributed generation, where we're taking coal generated electricity off the market. We're taking reliance on the electric grid off the market. We're making it less expensive. We're being cleaner about it. We're using a Pennsylvania product. That's all environment. So I look and I think there's trade-offs that have to be in play. And I think with all of the technology and innovation that we have in the city of Philadelphia, investments on that side to figure out how to make solar and wind a bigger part of our energy mix in the city of Philadelphia is something that I'd be committed to doing.
It sounds like you also favor the energy hub that has been talked about and some plans for you have maybe not so much?
Well, when we talk about Energy Hub, if you ask five people what they meant when they said Energy Hub, you might get five different answers. Right. I think the big one that people think about is the Philadelphia Energy yep. Solutions, bringing in oil,
using the infrastructure
it.
And
yep.
trains
yep.
and pipelines.
I look at, and some talk about, you know, sort of off, exporting to other countries and those kinds of things. Listen, I'm willing to entertain all of those ideas, but when I think Energy Hub, I think all of the above. There's an export market right now that's booming in PGW world. It's not sending natural gas in its gas form or its liquid form to other countries, but we're off-system sales trucking it. We're sending it to drilling equipment or long-haul trucking that's using natural gas, CNG. It's a cleaner. It's certainly cleaner than diesel or gasoline. And so we're doing that now, and it means a significant amount of revenue to the city of Philadelphia. I'm talking about replacing underground infrastructure infrastructure and the jobs that that brings. I'm talking about Energy Hub using the abundance of natural gas to attract manufacturing businesses and employing people not only in Philadelphia, not just in Philadelphia, but for Philadelphians. So I think energy efficiency, all of our dilapidated housing. I think about making them more energy efficient, removing asthma triggers, having better educational outcomes. There's a lot to the Energy Hub, and I think what we need to do is clearly define what it is, recognize that we do need to be moving towards more use of renewables. But in the meantime, what are we doing before we get there?
Tina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. If you have a question for our guest, Doug Oliver, again, one of the six Democrats running for mayor of the city of Philadelphia, I believe the fifth largest city in the country. And we got a bunch of comments here from Avi. Would you consider a project to draw new resources from big universities and from many of the highly educated retired folks in the suburbs in terms of helping the Philadelphia school district? I'm not exactly sure what he's referring to, but there was a time, in fact, when Ed Rendell was mayor, he would talk regionally. I mean, to think regionally. And is that, do you think that's a viable way to think about this city?
I do. I think we have to, because whether we're talking about energy or anything else, we talk about our regional impact. Our tourism and hospitality, that's a regional thing. Our arts and culture community, that's a regional thing. When we talk about energy infrastructure, our pipes don't just start and stop in Philadelphia. It's a connection thing. So even as we talk about the hub and what the impact is on the people around us, we have to be thinking about our neighbors in the surrounding counties. So when I do think of pilots, payments in lieu of taxes.
Right.
I am thinking regionally when I'm thinking about time and talent and where it comes from to solve for our educational challenges. I'm thinking regionally. And I think the Metropolitan Caucus that was established under Mayor Nutter's term a few years ago was a great place to start. It opened the lines of communications. We can have this conversation more easily. I also think it helps us as a city with our conversations in Harrisburg when we take a broader focus about who, quote unquote, we are, that it's not we, me, me, Philadelphia. When I say we, I really meant just me. But we collectively as a state, as a region, and certainly obviously as a city.
A tweet from Rainey saying, how do you overcome the considerable experience of the other candidates? Do you foresee larger media visibility for a campaign as Election Day draws near? And it is fair to say the other candidates have had more experience in public office. They're all older than you, if I can say that.
Mm-hmm.
And some have, you know, had these public accomplishments because they've been members of city council, things like that.
Well, I will say this. I cannot just create a 20-year legislative history, but they can't escape their 20-year legislative history. As I sit and I listen at these countless debates that we've been, I listen to the accomplishments and the things they've been able to do, and I will not lie. Sometimes it just is impressive. I mean, you can't do something for 25 years and not have accomplished something. Mm-hmm. What I will suggest, at the risk of sounding critical, is that the things that they've done haven't solved for our core problems. People don't leave the city because construction work sites aren't safe. They don't leave the city because of potholes or because taxi cabs don't have their medallions or tow trucks don't have proper rotation. They leave because they can't educate their kids. They leave because they feel unsafe. They leave because they can't find a job or they can't grow one. And all the accomplishments over 25 years haven't solved for those things. And so I will concede that experience in as the face in the elected office is there's value in it. But having been around politicians and elective office, you get a lot of experience that I think is helpful. And I think we've seen what mayors that come through the mayor making factory look like. We understand the decisions
that
they
make.
What
is the mayor making factory?
The mayor making factory is the idea that to run for mayor, you have to first be a city council person or a block captain or have held elected office or have put yourself in constraints that keep you from being the most effective mayor that you could be. The mayor making factory removes all independence from the mayor before he gets there, both through the offices he or she has held and through the funding mechanism through which they pay to get to the office. It removes and creates new lines of accountability to people other than the city of Philadelphia, and then we scratch our heads and wonder why we're ineffective. I seek to at least call the question and see what happens if we hire someone different.
Let me see what Dolores from Mantua has to say. Dolores, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. I've liked what you have to say so far. I have a question about affordable housing. I live in the Mantua area, and there's a lot of development. There's a lot of development in lots of areas around the city where there's schools, and it seems that all the housing is for students. A lot of the residents have been displaced because they were renters or because there were projects that have been torn down. And I just wonder, what would you do to address the problem of affordable housing?
Dolores, it's a good question. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Zach Oliver, go ahead.
Part and parcel of any progressive city is strong neighborhoods. I, just as a general rule through my administration, would be reinvesting in neighborhoods. I think John Street did a good job of clearing out a lot of dilapidated houses, crumbling, and blight that was associated with many neighborhoods across the city.
That was NTI, right?
Yes, there was NTI program, and I think Mayor Nutter was poised to start to build on that. He got waylaid by an economic crisis that took his attention elsewhere. I think the next mayor has to pick back up, has to start to invest in those neighborhoods. I think development in our neighborhoods is a good thing, but I also think there must be protections for people who are there. The most affordable house is the one that is already owned. And so investing in things like the Housing Trust Fund to make sure that existing homeowners have the resources that are necessary for basic system repair and staying in their homes is something a mayor has to think about. Making sure that people don't get taxed out of their home because there's now development in their neighborhoods. Just as a general rule, and I ask the business community this all the time, if you buy a stock for $100 and it grows to be worth $1,000, how many people call their stockbroker and give them $900?
Mm.
Furthermore, we complain about capital gains tax. We don't even want to be taxed on the profit. So if you believe that as a business community, then you must understand that a homeowner who's been in their home for many, many years and now sees development increasing the value of their property, that they must be protected. Beyond that, when development occurs, I'd like to see that the developers have to have as part of their development plan affordable housing, transitional housing, supportive housing, as well as protection of open space in our neighborhoods. It's a plan, and I think the Planning Commission, the mayor, have to work together to make sure that there is always affordable housing and our neighborhoods remain diverse and equitably developed.
And we're almost out of time here. There are something like 40,000 properties in the city that are either vacant or falling apart mm-hmm. or creating an eyesore within communities. There's been a lot of effort to try to create a land bank to expedite some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is that happening fast enough?
I don't think anything happens fast enough, but I do like the track that it's on. Getting the land bank established was yeoman's work. We have everybody on board. Now it's the application. We have the Zoning and Planning Commission now have overlay of a new zoning code. That's fantastic. But now the devil is in the details. We've got 17 council members, 10 of which have districts, and they have ideas for what they want to do in their district and how that land would be distributed. I think there's conversations that need to be had. Again, set the goal for where we want to be, and it makes the conversations about how we get there a lot easier.
That was Councilmanic prerogative, right? You were
Indeed.
Kind of referencing that.
I'm acknowledging.
Which side are you on that?
Well, it's not a written
Briefly.
Rule. If it was a written rule, I'd try and undo it. But it's not a written rule. It's a policy and a culture, and so you have to accept it. You can't just make it move because it was never written in the first place. And so I'll accept the challenge. And I think that building strong relationships, cooperative relationships with council members, not starting off with the idea that they're the enemy, makes it a little easier to have those conversations when they believe that you accept their position.
Well, Doug Oliver, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.
No problem. And he is running for mayor of Philadelphia, one of six Democrats running for mayor. And all of them will be joining us next week on Radio Times, spending an hour with each of these candidates. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. We'd like to know what you think about these candidate interviews. Also, go to Newsworks and much more information about many of the races here in the city and also a number of the issues as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.